The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. International Overdose Awareness Day is August 31st. We'll hear about that on today's show, but first, Leo Beletsky is an associate professor of law and health sciences at Northeastern University, where he's the faculty director of the Health Injustice Action Lab. He participated recently on a panel discussion sponsored by the Health Injustice Action Lab entitled Advancing Syringe Services in the U.S., The Untapped Role of the Americans with Disabilities Act.
So we're hoping today to provide the context for this article, why it's significant and timely. We're going to go through sort of the background of the progression of legal cases that bring us here, and then we'll kind of dive into the sort of the meat of the legal argument. So today I'm joined by Valerie Blake, who's Associate Dean for Faculty Development and Research in the newly minted and a professor of law at West Virginia University School of Law. And Val is our team's ADA expert. So she will be taking on the kind of the legal, talking about the legal details of the piece. Val is valiantly joining us with no electricity, no internet, by sheer willpower. So if she drops off at some point during the presentation, it's because of technical issues, but she's assured us that she's got it handled. So hopefully it'll work out. My name is Leo Beletsky. I'm a professor of law and health sciences at Northeastern University. I'm also the faculty director of the Health Injustice Action Lab at Northeastern and on the faculty of UC San Diego School of Medicine. So the context for this article is that even though we're now in the third decade of the overdose crisis in the United States, and there's a significant burden of both overdose and infectious disease transmitted through injection drug use, there's been a general underfunding and underutilization of harm reduction services in the United States. It's been, harm reduction has essentially been a bottom-up innovation in the United States where it's been essentially an act of civil disobedience from the very start. And that bottom-up innovation has over time percolated to municipal support, governmental support, and then state governmental support, and now only recently federal governmental support for harm reduction services, which is a true tragedy and travesty because a lot of folks have died or have acquired blood-borne pathogens or endocarditis and other issues related to drug use. And all of these issues would have been preventable if we had harm reduction at scale and in terms of numbers, the programs that we should have had all along. The stigma associated with substance use and addiction really has cast a shadow on harm reduction programs. And in many jurisdictions, they are not able to open their doors and to function at scale because of the various barriers, both legal and practical, that are put in their way. And being kind of a harm reduction lawyer, I guess, over time, myself and a handful of others, such as Corey Davis and Scott Burris and some others, have consistently gotten requests from besieged harm reduction programs around the country to assist them with various legal challenges and barriers that are put in their path as they try to help people who use drugs. And there's been very little in terms of sort of legal tools that are available to assist these programs as they battle these legal challenges. Over time, what's emerged is that there are kind of dormant legal tools that are available, but are not being utilized to protect these programs and assist these programs. And so a few years ago, Kat De Los Reyes, who was a student at Northeastern, decided to focus on this issue by researching as part of her final project in my drug law and policy course, the ability to utilize the Americans with Disabilities Act as a shield against various legal attacks for harm reduction programs. And academia moves at a very slow pace, but as we started to work on this sort of legal theory, we actually were able to deploy it in a couple of situations, including in Washington State and in more recent situation in New Jersey, where serene service programs were being basically threatened with shutdowns using discriminatory zoning. The theory that the ADA applies was something that we were able to pose to the governments and basically highlight the fact that they could be at risk of litigation under the ADA if they actually proceeded with these zoning restrictions. This also was something that we posed in the situation in Orange County, California. And in two of the cases, we thought that it turned out that the theory was persuasive. In the Orange County situation, it wasn't persuasive to the city council, and they went ahead with the zoning restriction. But at this point, the legal theory that we've developed that Val's going to talk about is simply that. It is a theory. And what we've done is kind of laid it out in this article. And we're hoping that it will get picked up by lawyers to help equip harm reduction programs to kind of strengthen their legal standing. In this work, we really are building on the foundation that was laid by Legal Action Center and other organizations that have used the ADA to protect substance use treatment services in the past. And that set of case law, that precedent, creates the persuasive legal foundation for us to argue that, to analogize essentially ADA protections being applied to substance use treatment to harm reduction programs, and say, well, if the ADA protects those programs, then it also protects these programs as well.
That was Leo Beletsky, Associate Professor of Law and Health Sciences at Northeastern University and Faculty Director of the Health and Justice Action Lab. Now here's Valerie Blake, Professor of Law and Associate Dean for Faculty Development and Research at the West Virginia University College of Law.
So Leo set this issue up really nicely. Let me say at the outset, the paper is dealing with one specific subset of potential legal attack against safe syringe programs, which is the use of NIMBYism, or the not in my backyard zoning restrictions, that would seek to essentially create such restrictive zoning measures that safe syringe programs couldn't find anywhere in a community to reside. And that is entirely the purpose of some of these zoning measures at often the local, sometimes the state level, is to try to craft a sort of laser-focused zoning law that is targeted at methadone centers or safe syringe programs, and that appears to be neutral, right? But sets up various zoning restrictions that essentially make it impossible for these programs to be in place. So they lack a home. And so this legal argument is just looking at the potential case that NIMBY restrictions against safe syringe programs is discriminatory on the basis of disability, some possible defenses that a city or state might try to leverage, and how we could attack those defenses. Okay. And to say there's a lot of different ways that communities might otherwise try to you know, mitigate or minimize the presence of these syringe programs that our argument doesn't get at, okay, that we need to do more thinking on. Okay, so we're focused on the Americans with Disabilities Act and the Rehabilitation Act, specifically Section 504. Both of those laws address disability discrimination, and they have very specific criteria in terms of which entities must follow these laws, what it counts in terms of whether you're disabled or not, what counts as discrimination, who can bring the suits, and then a number of different defenses. So I'm going to first start by walking through the body of cases that we're analogizing to. So there were a number of cases that dealt with zoning restrictions trying to eliminate the locations of methadone treatment centers. And so we're going to talk about how those cases played out in court, and then we'll talk about what that might mean for the latest sort of attack against syringe programs. Okay. So, Americans with Disabilities Act bans disability discrimination by a number of different actors. Title I addresses employment. Title II addresses state and local officials. Title III addresses some private entities. Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act also bans disability discrimination using the same definitions of disability, and it addresses recipients of federal money. In our case, these issues first came before the courts when state and local governments set up zoning restrictions against methadone clinics, saying things like, you can't be within 500 feet of a school or 500 feet of a hospital or 500 feet of what have you. Owners or patients at the clinics brought suit saying, you're discriminating against us based on disability. You can't have these restrictive zoning mechanisms. You're prohibiting us from having access to care. And we have a few circuit courts who sounded off on that. So the first question was whether or not state and local governments even need to comply with the Americans with Disabilities Act or the Rehab Act. And in those circuit courts, they made clear that they did in fact have to follow the ADA and the Rehab Act for a couple of reasons. So mainly the boards who are making these zoning decisions are state and local officials, and they come under the Rehab Act because of the fact that they're very often recipients of federal money of some kind or another, grants, various programs. So they're covered by the Rehab Act, recipients of federal money. On the ADA side, they come under the ADA under Title II, which expressly covers state and local actors. Okay, so no question that these government officials making zoning decisions have to comply with these two federal statutes. The next question that the circuit courts addressed was whether or not zoning was a covered action. Okay, so are zoning decisions something that's covered by the ADA and the Rehab Act? And again, the circuit courts were pretty clear that zoning decisions are a part and parcel of state and local government action, and there's really no reason to sort of treat them differently than other sorts of state action. So zoning decisions are something that has to comply with ADA and Rehab Act and cannot discriminate on the basis of disability. Okay, so you have to comply with ADA and Rehab Act as state and local officials in your zoning decisions. The next question was whether or not individuals who suffer from substance abuse are disabled within the meaning of the ADA and the Rehab Act. And here we've had a number of different court cases over the years who have made plain that that is the case. So addiction and addiction recovery count as disabilities for purposes of federal law. The kind of, you know, there's very specific criteria for what counts as a disability under the ADA. typically, you either qualify because your condition substantially limits a major activity in your life, which many individuals who have an addiction can prove in one way or another. And we don't like to generalize, but you know, we have a body of cases in which people who have substance use disorders have been able to show that those conditions eliminate their everyday life in one way or another. Another category in which you can qualify as having a disability is if you're perceived by others as having a disability, if you're perceived by others as having a limit or an impairment. And people with addiction have been able to show in the past that they count as disabled under the statute, under that theory as well. Okay, so, and I will say recently, the Department of Justice under the Biden administration actually issued a public statement saying that they consider substance use disorder to be a disability for purposes of the ADA. So we have sort of further evidence coming from the federal government recently that this is a category that's protected. Okay, now, so this is where things start to get a little more challenging for the courts. So we have state officials engaging in zoning behavior that implicates people with disabilities when they create zoning restrictions that eliminate the presence of methadone clinics. The question was whether or not that counted as discrimination on the basis of disability and whether it was defensible in some way. We have two circuit courts, one, the Ninth Circuit in Bay Area versus Antioch, and a second case, Sixth Circuit, MX Group versus Covington. Both cases say that discriminatory zoning is discrimination on the basis of disability. And effectively, they call it facial discrimination. So the fact that these zoning measures essentially eliminate from the community any presence of a methadone clinic, and that they're surgically focused on methadone clinics, or in this case, potentially syringe programs, that's a form of facial discrimination that's effectively treating this group of people who depend on this service differently than others. So if we had a zoning law that, you know, said no medical center of any kind can be within 500 feet of a school, that would be very different than these zoning laws, which say no methadone clinic can be within 500 feet. Okay. So it's a focus on a particular class, right, of people who need methadone. And that's where the court said this really is discrimination and it's facial, right? It's a sort of an intentional targeting of a particular group. So the most common defense that we saw mounted from zoning boards when we saw these methadone clinic cases was a what's called a direct threat defense. So you are permitted, if you're covered by the ADA, to treat people with a disability differently if the person with the disability threatens your safety and the safety of others. The most famous case of a direct threat defense that some of you may be familiar with was a case in which it was called Bragdon versus Abbott. A patient had was HIV positive. She sought out dental care. The dentist said, "I'll treat your dental needs, but we have to do it in a hospital where, you know, I will be safer from potentially being infected with the virus, and that will be at your expense." She brought suit. It went up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said, "You're allowed to discriminate on the basis of disability if your safety is at stake, right? So you're allowed to treat someone with HIV differently, but the standard is an objective one, okay? So any dentist can't say, I feel threatened. They have to mount objective evidence that there is a demonstrable risk to them, right? Not a subjective risk, but an objective one. So in this case, the zoning boards are saying, look, methadone treatment centers put all of the community at risk. It increases the risk of violence. It increases the risk of danger to the community. It increases the risk of drugs being present in the community. And so that's why we don't want these methadone treatment centers in our backyard. And so these people, we admit they have disabilities, but we are allowed to discriminate against them because they pose a threat to us and our community. And what the court said was no dice, and no dice because you're not explaining to us an objective risk. You're not showing an objective direct threat. In all of the circuit court cases, the zoning officials were not able to show that the presence of a methadone clinic actually increased rates of criminality, drug addiction in the area, or anything like that. And in fact, you know, the judges in these opinions, you know, somewhat insinuate that the lack of evidence is sort of proving the point, right? That there's a lot of stigma and bias and stereotyping going on that's sort of driving these denials of these NIMBY actions against methadone clinics. And there's not a lot of objective data to back up the idea that they, you know, harm the community in any way. In fact, the data seems to suggest it helps the community. Okay, so there's our sort of background legal theory. And then just moving quickly forward to talk about what this means for safe syringe programs. I think you probably were following along with me and checking all the boxes and thinking, oh, this is pretty analogous. I hope so, right? That was our thinking when we wrote the paper. Okay, so let's take a modern case of a city official who says, we don't want a syringe program in our community, so we're going to set up a rule that says, not within 500 feet of a school or a barber shop or a train track, et cetera, et cetera.
That was Valerie Blake, Professor of Law and Associate Dean for Faculty Development and Research at the West Virginia University College of Law. She was speaking on a panel entitled Advancing Syringe Services in the U.S., The Untapped Role of the ADA, which was sponsored by the Health Injustice Action Lab. Find the Health Injustice Action Lab on the web at healthinjustice.org. Also at their website, you can get a full text copy of the article, Advancing Syringe Services in the United States, The Untapped Role of the Americans with Disabilities Act. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. As I mentioned at the top of the show, International Overdose Awareness Day is August 31st. I spoke about that recently with Haven Wheelock. She's the Drug Users Health Services Program Supervisor for Outside In, a Portland, Oregon nonprofit.
I'm Haven Wheelock. I run the Drug Users Health Services Program at Outside In in Portland, Oregon. So Overdose Awareness Day has been around for a long time. In the United States, over 100,000 people died last year from overdoses. And it is a crisis. And I get a little teary when I talk about it. But so every year, Outside In, for the last 10 years, has hosted a memorial to honor the lives of people we have lost to overdose and to commit to fighting this overdose crisis. So we will be, this year we will be hosting a memorial service and reading of names of folks who we've lost to overdose on the 31st at 6 p.m. in Shemansky Park, which is in the Southwest Park blocks between Maine and Salmon. And we're just going to come together and remember folks and show up and give out some naloxone and, you know, really be present to try and give people, there's so much stigma associated with death by overdose. And while many of us have been affected by these losses, it really feels important to me to give us a space to grieve collectively for these losses. So we'll be in the park safely, distant, tugging on each other and really remembering those people who so often don't get remembered because of their addiction. And yeah, I'm hoping it's going to be a beautiful event. And it's the first time we've done a like more formal memorial since the pandemic started. We've done like art installations the last 2 years because of COVID precaution. So we're excited this year to be able to actually have a time-based event where we can be together and remember folks that deserve our remembering. Outside In is an organization that's been in our community for over 50 years. We actually offer a pretty broad range of services. We do services, drop-in space, housing, case management for homeless youth, so people 25 and under. And that's kind of where we started. However, we also have a primary care clinic for anyone who's low income. So if anyone needs any kind of primary care, and that's open to anyone regardless of age. I think people often think of Outside In as a youth-focused organization, but all of our healthcare services are all ages. So if you need a doc, you should come see ours because they're kind of awesome. In addition to that, we actually run the third oldest legal syringe access program in the country. And that's the part that I run. So I run all of our stuff that is associated with drug use. So overdose prevention work, all of our syringe access, harm reduction work, HIV, hepatitis C screening, testing. It's a pretty lovely place to be a part of.
That was Haven Wheelock, Drug Users Health Services Program Supervisor at Outside In in Portland, Oregon. Full disclosure, I'm a supporter of Outside In and a monthly donor. They provide vital services and do tremendous work. Find out more at outsidein.org. And for now, that's it. Thank you for joining us. This has been Century of Lies. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. Find this edition of Century, along with an archive of past shows, at the Drug Truth Network website, drugtruth.net. You'll find a link there to subscribe to the Century of Lies podcast. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy reform and the failed war on drugs. For now, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long. For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the Century of Lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy. We'll